content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Chris Canagla for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Walter Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the March edition of Walter Magazine. And the first article that I'm going to read for you today is called Botany in Bloom by Bree Arthur. A tour of Dr. Dennis Werner's living laboratory. What are we talking about? Well, his living laboratory is really quite special. In the quiet Swift Creek area near Raleigh, tucked behind a modest home, is a garden shaped by patience, science, and decades of close observation. It belongs to Dr. Dennis Werner, a longtime professor and plant breeder at North Carolina State University. While his career has influenced agriculture and landscapes across the Southeast and beyond, his home garden offers a more intimate view of how a lifetime in horticulture translates into a deeply personal place. A lifelong gardener, Werner grew up in rural Pennsylvania, surrounded by family members who encouraged his curiosity about growing plants. Gardening was woven into daily life. Neighbors shared seedlings of their specialty crops, and young Werner eagerly experimented with whatever he could get his hands on. He developed an early affinity for gourds. I was drawn to their rapid growth and the way their fruits twisted and swelled into unusual shapes, he says. During his teenage years, he could often be found walking through the forest, tree identification book in hand, driven by a strong desire to better understand the species that surround him. Those early experiences sparked a fascination with plant variation and potential, Werner says. Werner entered Penn State on the forestry technology track, and it was not until he transferred to the main campus his junior year that his academic path shifted. There he discovered botany and horticulture, disciplines that combined science, creativity, and applied problem-solving. With encouragement from his longtime mentor, Dr. Richard Craig, Werner found his direction and passion for plant genetics. He went on to earn both a master's degree and a PhD from Michigan State University, focusing on edible and ornamental plant breeding. It was here that my interest in improving and creating novel plants for real-world landscapes truly took hold, Werner says. In 1979, Werner joined NC State's Department of Horticultural Science, beginning a career that would span decades and influence generations of students, growers, and researchers. His work initially focused on peach breeding and genetics, leading to the introduction of varieties such as Contender, Challenger, China Pearl, and Carolina Gold. Later, his efforts centered on woody plant improvement, with an emphasis on better form, improved flowering, and adaptability to climate. Over time, his research programs led to the introduction of numerous plants now familiar to gardeners and growers alike. These include trademark dwarf butterfly bushes such as Blue Chip and Miss Molly, and what has become a landmark achievement, the first controlled breeding program of native redbuds. Stepping into Werner's home garden feels a bit like entering a living laboratory, though one softened by age, intention, and restraint. Colorful perennial borders mingle with vegetables, pollinator plantings, a specimen tree and shrub collection, and productive blueberries, reflecting both diversity and practicality. But the red buds steal the spotlight, particularly in spring when they flower and leaf out in a spectrum of colors, textures, and forms. Plant breeding is not for the faint of heart. Decades can pass before results are visible or meaningful. For Werner, his motivation has always been rooted in the process as much as the outcome. Every step is exciting. You make a cross, and it takes. Then you collect the seed, and it germinates. There is a pipeline of progress, but the anticipation of what the result will be is the most exciting, he says. That sense of curiosity has sustained him through the slow timelines and inevitable setbacks that come with breeding trees. His long arc of work in redwood breeding has produced exceptional results. Flamethrower was the breakthrough, Werner explains, describing his trademark multicolored leaf redbud. When a soybean breeder inquired about the colorful tree at the research station, I knew we had a winner. confirming the broader appeal, this introduction was awarded Plant of the Year by the Royal Horticultural Society at the 2021 Chelsea Flower Show in London. This was an incredible, let me find the other page here, an incredible achievement. Other famous varieties bred by Werner include Ruby Falls, a purple leaf weeping form, and his trademark Dwarf Redbuds, marketed as garden gems, which include five distinct varieties, each selected for compact structure and unique foliage coloration. Over the decades, I've had to transition with the industry, he says. Selecting varieties with compact habits meets the needs of today's smaller landscapes worldwide. When asked how many rose red buds he currently grows, Werner laughs, well, according to my wife, not enough. She loves them all. Space, however, demands discipline. Rather than accumulating plants, he focuses on maintaining the best selections. Seven standout varieties are carefully tended, closed, observed, and used in future crosses. Among them, Golden Falls, a chartreuse-colored weeping variant, remains a favorite. It shows no leaf scorch, even in full sun conditions, and retains its golden color even through the summer, says Werner. For a breeder, those observations are just as important as formal data. Beyond individual plants, the garden reflects Werner's belief that gardening is a lifelong practice. During his tenure as director of the J.C. Ralston Arboretum, he put that philosophy into action, shaping the landscape as a living classroom rooted in patience and curiosity. Although he officially retired from NC State in 2019, his engagement has not slowed. Werner continues his redbud breeding work and remains deeply invested in his home garden, which still offers lessons much like the classrooms he once led. Whether working within a university breeding program or tending a backyard garden, Werner's work demonstrates a deep respect for plants and for the people who grow them. Beyond his professional achievements, Werner is a devoted husband, father, and grandfather, and animal lover, and a generous presence in the Raleigh community. As Mark Washington, the current director of the J.C. Ralston Arboretum, notes, working with Denny is a constant lesson. He thinks deeply about the subject at hand, and his influence has made me a better leader, gardener, and person. Okay, this next article from the Vault section of the magazine is titled From Fossil to Fame. At the North Carolina Museum of National Sciences, the confirmation of a new dinosaur species paints a different picture of the Cretaceous period as we knew it. Over the past decade, Dr. Lindsay Zano, head of paleontology at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, has worked tirelessly to bring what she knew would be one of the most significant paleontological finds of the century to Raleigh, the dueling dinosaurs, the intact remains of a Tyrannosaur and Triceratops who died in combat 67 million years ago. The remarkably preserved fossils and whatever Cretaceous secrets they held were, as Zano said at the time of acquisition, like a big, unopened Christmas present. Now, less than 2 years since the museum's interactive SECU Dino Lab became the new home of the dueling dinosaurs, the first gift has been unwrapped, and it's a whole new species. The small Tyrannosaur, which had been believed to be a teenage T-Rex for the 20 years since a Montana rancher first spotted its pelvis protruding out of the ground, is in fact a mature Nanotyrannus lancensis. Using CT scans and imaging to look inside the blocks of earth housing the fossils, paleontologists at the NCMNS uncovered characteristics in their Tyrannosaur specimen that set it apart from a T-Rex, including larger forelimbs, more teeth, like they need more teeth, fewer tail vertebrae, and distinct nerve patterns. Growth rings and spinal fusion data proved that the specimen was an adult. At 18 feet long and 1,500 pounds, it is only around a tenth of the body mass and half the length of a full-grown T-Rex. The discovery flips decades of T-Rex discovery on its head. The implications are difficult to overstate, says Zano. The fact is, much of our current understanding of T-Rex was built on 3 decades of research that unknowingly mixed data from Nanotyrannus with that of Tyrannosaurus, two different tyrannosaurs that aren't even closely related. Most of that research now needs a second look. A long-standing debate in the world of paleontology questioned whether Nanotyrannus was a distinct species or simply an adolescent T. rex. Zano and her co-author, Dr. James Napoli, vertebrate paleontologist at Stony Brook University, answered that question with their study, which was published in Nature in the fall. In the past, paleontologists have used Nanotyrannus fossils as models of T. rex behavior and growth. But Zano and Napoli's research reveals that they are biologically incompatible. It means that T. rex's dominance in the final million years leading up to the asteroids was not unchallenged. To me, what's exciting about this discovery is that it opens the door to a whole new series of questions about how these drastically different predators, one built for brute strength and one built for speed, interacted in the twilight of the dinosaurs. What we can say right now is that life at the end of the Cretaceous period was a lot more colorful than we had imagined, says Zano. Though smaller than T-Rex, Nanotyrannus was still a valiant competitor and a quicker, more agile hunter. Its existence proves that predators' diversity at the end of the age of the dinosaurs was richer than previous research suggested. Now a new question arises. How many other mistakenly identified dinosaur species could be hiding in plain sight? Scientists have long debated whether dinosaurs were thriving or diminishing when the asteroids struck at the end of the Cretaceous period. Zano says, without understanding the number of dinosaurs alive at the time and the ecological roles they filled, we cannot document how mass extinction events have shaped life on our planet in the past, nor how they are likely to affect us in the future. The specimens at the NCMNS have affectionately been named after two North Carolina locations. Murphy, the Triceratops, is named for the westernmost town in the state, signifying the strength and longevity of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Manteo, the Nanotyrannus, is named for the coastal town on Roanoke Island, home, of course, to the Lost Colony and the original American Mystery. This is just the beginning. We have decades of incredible research in the pipeline on the dueling dinosaurs. This is all made possible not just by the outstanding preservation of the fossil carcasses, plus the talent and dedication of the team we have put together, but also by the community backing we have received, says Zano. The people of North Carolina and beyond banded together to protect these fossils for science and the public alike, a powerful force for good that will continue to pay dividends. Okay, this next article is entitled Prime Time by Catherine Curran. And here's a subject we can all agree on, barbecue. Well, no, there's a lot of disagreement on barbecue. But at Prime Barbecue, Christopher Prieto combines heart, science, and hospitality. Rain or shine, from Tuesday to Saturday, there's a line wrapped around the building at Prime Barbecue in Knightdale. Folks show up as early as 8 a.m., even though the doors don't open till 11, because the restaurants only open until the last slice of brisket is served. It's no surprise to owner and pitmaster Christopher Prieto. I wanted to create a barbecue mecca, a big destination restaurant where everyone could come and experience the different techniques and traditions behind barbecue, he says. Prieto's skill for destination-worthy food is fueled by a unique combination of influences. He was born in Bryan, Texas, where his father worked as a scientist, and his mother, who grew up in Puerto Rico, cooked every meal from scratch. My whole childhood, I really didn't eat processed foods, and everything was better when it was made by my mom, he says. It was in Texas where Prieto first caught the barbecue bug in the 90s, learning to perfect regional specialties like brisket and smoked sausage. Prieto, 42, soon learned that, like his mom's cooking, barbecue is a labor of love and a practice that can be honed. My dad taught me a lot about cooking with science and understanding the why behind what I'm doing, he says. As Prieto developed his craft, he kept meticulous journals, testing recipes, tracking the temperatures within his equipment, noting step-by-step instructions for different types and cuts of meat. When he was in his late teens, his father's work relocated the family to Franklin, North Carolina, and Prieto was introduced to a whole new style of the craft, which offered a new challenge to master. By age 21, Prieto was on the barbecue competition circuit, cooking at festivals and events across the country. He was one of the youngest pitmasters at the time. My mom would show up and wash dishes, and my dad was the first sous chef. He would sit there and help me bring out my notes, and we would create a pattern and a cooking procedure, says Prieto. We were very exact and were obsessed with becoming the best. The research apparently paid off. Prieto started winning those competitions among various television appearances, including Food Network's Chopped and BBQ Brawl with Bobby Flay and Michael Simon. He earned an appearance on Destination America's BBQ Pitmaster series in 2014. That led to a 2015 book deal with Southern Living to produce its Ultimate Book of Barbecue, the complete year-round guide to grilling and smoking, which is still being reprinted today. I'll read that again. The Ultimate Book of Barbecue, the complete year-round guide to grilling and smoking, which is still being reprinted today. While Prieto was cooking barbecue as a side gig, he worked in hospitality with OSI Restaurant Partners, which owns Outback Steakhouse and Carrabba's Italian Grill. There, he learned the ins and outs of operating a restaurant. In hospitality, I was obsessed with people more than food. I knew I wanted to open a barbecue restaurant, but at the same time, I just wanted to be in the restaurant business. Later, he went back to business school and worked at RTP-based life sciences company Quintiles, now IQVIA, as he kept up his barbecue practice under the business name Prime. When I wasn't working, I was catering, he says. During lunch breaks, I would have my coolers, and I would go and pick up all the meat at the meat market. While building up his catering business with Prime, Prieto also taught cooking classes with the Wounded Warrior Project, where he met Justin Raup, a North Carolina-based Army veteran. After a couple of classes with Prieto, Raup caught the same barbecue bug. I signed up for his brisket class. I've always enjoyed cooking, but after that class, I thought, I need to be able to cook this at home. Raup says he bought a cheap smoker and smoked on it every weekend. I burned stuff, lost sleep, all of that fun stuff, and I kept going to class. The two became friends, and Raup signed on to help Prieto however he could. He literally washed dishes outside, contest after contest, says Prieto. He worked his way up into our trailer just like he did in the military. He became my right-hand guy. Prieto had long hoped to open Prime as a restaurant, and in 2017, the city of Knightdale approached him to open a concept as it developed the new Knightdale Station Park. That's what I was being called to do, he said. I had the vision for Prime Barbecue in college. The drawing I made of the exact building footprint is framed in my office. He brought Raup on as general manager, and they worked on a plan. It literally took us a week to design the space. Then we presented it to the town, and they approved it. The build took almost 2 years as they navigated permits and approvals for a wood-fired restaurant. The vision included a bright and airy space inside with a clear navigation to the counter to order food. Outside, a covered patio and open-air lawn provided plenty of space for picnic tables. The goal was to open Prime in March 2020, but due to the pandemic, they pivoted to a takeout-only opening in May. It was not ideal, but it forced us to learn a lot, says Prieto. The silver lining, we started to understand the operations of what was important. Since we weren't welcoming guests in a full capacity, the focus shifted to cooking, trimming and seasoning everything that every day. He says by the time the pandemic eased, they streamlined their operations and the menus. Unlike many North Carolina barbecue joints, Prime isn't about tomato versus vinegar or beef versus pork. Barbecue is the technique, plain and simple, cooking with wood and coals, Prieto says. At Prime, you'll find a little bit of Texas barbecue, like melt-in-your-mouth brisket, but also classic North Carolina whole hog barbecue. There's Prieto's spin on Puerto Rican rice and beans, inspired by the way his mom made it. There's a juicy smoked turkey, pork ribs, a smoked sausage with a kick and burnt ends only on Wednesdays and Fridays. There's the Texas Twinkie, a jumbo jalapeno popper wrapped in bacon filled with pork and Gouda pimento cheese, and a sweet potato salad, a spin on the classic made with our abundant local crop. It takes more than 24 hours to make his decadent creamed corn, and Prieto can wax poetic about the care and time each dish takes, down to the sides, like the sweet and hot Big Boss beans made with pork fat and topped with chopped brisket. It's too simple to say Prime is North Carolina or Texas barbecue. I lived in Texas nearly 20 years of my life, and I lived in North Carolina for 15. That's why we cook in so many different styles, so many different ways, says Prieto. You're cooking all day long, prepping for hours for the moment someone takes their first bite. Once guests get up to the counter, it's a chance to learn about the food and connect with the team. You go up to a board, you get it crafted right in front of you. I feel that's the most intimate way barbecue's been done for the longest time, says Prieto. He's there most days to welcome his guests, and don't be surprised to see his family, maybe even one of his five children, helping bus tables. We're in the business of people. We just happen to cook good barbecue, he says. Over the past few years, Prieto and Prime Barbecue have gained a cult following along with numerous accolades. In 2025 alone, Prieto was named a James Beard semifinalist for Best Chef Southeast, and Prime Barbecue received Michelin's Bib Gourmand recognition. Prieto also had a new refined barbecue steakhouse concept, STQ, on the horizon to open in Research Triangle Park in the coming year. We're at the point where all things we prayed for, all the things we worked for so hard, are now here, says Prieto. But that's not where you end. That's where you start. Well, if barbecue is a passion, a close second would be golf. This is a story by Stephen Smith, actually a review of a book called A Quick Nine Before Dark by Bill Fields, titled A Golfer's Life, A Sweetly Crafted Tale of an Obsession with the Game. In longtime North Carolina native golf writer Bill Fields' A Quick Nine Before Dark, there are no scandals, no shocking moral shortcomings, no vilifications of former friends, just storytelling at its best with efficient use of descriptive prose. Born in Pinehurst in 1959, Fields' obsession with sports began when he was a child, gravitating toward any game that involved a ball. When he failed to become a basketball star, he turned to golf, though his focus on the game was waxed and waned until he was a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he wrote for the Daily Tar Heel. After graduation, he knocked around the golf world, promoting the game, until he accepted a position with the Athens Banner-Herald, which would evolve into an associate editorship at Golf World. What followed was a series of positions that eventually led back to Golf World, the magazine that started in the same town where he was born. Fields covered tournaments in the United States and overseas, which brought him into contact with the greatest golfers of our time. How many golfers can boast that they've played the game with Sam Snead and Tiger Woods? But A Quick Nine Before Dark is more than another golf book. It is also about becoming a writer and what it takes to remain ascendant in a field where technology advances at breakneck speed. From the moment Fields, as an elementary school kid, put pencil to paper and wrote, "I like to write," his life had been about arranging the right words in the best possible order. Fields' writing is unfailingly lucid, exact, and engaging. When he feels the need to shine, he does precisely that, as with this excerpted Golf World description of Davis Love III as he captured a major title. Quote, "The conclusion of the 97th PGA Championship was soggy and sweet like strawberries and sponge cake. As quickly as the late afternoon rain had come to Sunday, on Sunday to Winged Foot Golf Club in Mamaroneck, New York, it stopped, and the sun peeked through an angry sky. Two rainbows arched over the course at just the right moment, as if scripted by Frank Capra himself, and for Davis Love III, there wasn't a burden in sight. When the occasional somber moment intrudes, it's handled with grace and thoughtful solemnity, as when Fields learned by phone that his former wife, Marianne, has died. Nothing in divorce recovery books, the radio talk show advice, or the support of friends in the wake of a failed marriage had prepared me for these words. The deaths of his mother and father are likewise handled directly but with a necessary touch of sentiment. Life is ragged. Voids linger. Loose ends are everywhere. Today, Field's work requires him to live in Connecticut, but local readers will recognize familiar places like Knollwood, Foxfire Golf Club, and Mid Pines. But even if you've never whacked a golf ball, it's easy to be swept up by Field's beautifully crafted prose and the twists and turns of his life as a golf writer. And we're going to return to the garden now briefly for a short article called On Feeding the Birds by Helen Yost, welcoming song into the garden with shrubs and seeds. During a deep slumber, I begin to hear dawn songs, first the American robin, making himself known well before sunrise, followed by the northern cardinal and the Carolina wren. The wren's a small bird with a mighty call. The male will sing a loud, complex teakettle dawn song, hoping to attract a female. She will sing a simpler chirr. These sounds are a welcome alarm for me to begin my day, and my garden provides various types of feed to keep all of these visitors returning. Many berry-producing shrubs form berries in March, while others persist through the winter, providing food through spring. Eastern red cedar produces small, blue, waxy, berry-like cones that are a staple for cedar waxwings and robins. Robins eat protein-rich earthworms and insects the first part of their day when the ground is damp, then switch to berries and seeds in the second part of the day. Winterberry holly produces heavy crops in December that can persist into early spring to feed eastern bluebirds and woodpeckers. Wax myrtle produces small waxy berries that are a favorite of the yellow-rumped warblers. While I try to plant food sources for the wildlife in my garden, I also have feeders to watch their activity from the warm inside. Black oil sunflower seed is the best overall seed for the birds, attracting cardinals, chickadees, titmice, and jays. Safflower will attract nuthatches. Niger, marketed as thistle, feeds goldfinches, purple finches, and pine siskins. This can be purchased in a sack for hanging or poured into a thistle feeder. Suet is essential in winter and early spring for woodpeckers and insect eaters, providing vital fats. Unsalted peanuts will attract woodpeckers, jays, titmice, and nut thatches, also squirrels. Millet attracts ground-feeding birds like doves, juncos, and sparrows. As we enter spring later this month, perhaps you too will be inspired to invite more bird songs into your home garden. And I think we have time for one last little thing, which is a poem by Catherine Carter. Time begins again. This is called Time Begins. Time begins again when the first bloom of winter, honeysuckle, opens its faintly sparkling gold, white, or roseate folds and lips to reveal yellow tongues to the first bee who braves the cold outside the hive's close knot, leaves the dwindling honey cells to ship the first nectar. Time begins sooner each year, first Groundhog Day, then New Year's, then Christmas, and some greenhouse years Thanksgiving, until sooner or later it won't stop at all. Though what never stops can never begin again. Time and the bees no longer have time to rest in the frost's long cool from all that relentless tick and chime. It's also the time that's too short, and we go out on the spiky bush, bend a few sprigs, breathe up that wild sweetness that pollen's bright stain. We participate in one more feeding of the bees. Well, I'm afraid we've just about run out of time for this episode of Walter Magazine. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Chris Canangla, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of the program intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Available as a podcast at your website, ncreadingservice.org. Yeah, any comments or questions, you can call us at 919-832-5100.